It's Friday, April 14th, 2017. Another not-so-good Friday, at least if we're talking about the future of democracy. I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. This week in Trumplandia, Americans learn a new vocabulary word. Say it with me now, MOAB. Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb. But you can call it Mother. In order to avoid protesters so she can more effectively destroy public education, we are paying almost $8 million for special federal marshals to protect Betsy DeVos. Safely past Women's History Month, Trump signs a bill, behind closed doors, of course, that may leave as many as 4 million women without access to medical services. Another former Trump campaign staffer registering as a foreign agent, that makes two we know of, and Carter Page. Really, Carter Page is still in the news. Supreme Court now armed to repeal the 20th century. Gorsuch will cut his teeth on voting rights, actually today. And Jeff Sessions heads to the border to announce that he is weaponizing the Justice Department to take a stand against the filth. His words from his prepared remarks. Oh, and let's not forget North Korea, folks. Can you say, ah, Shiba? Closer to home, anti-EPA director of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, heads to PA coal mine to announce his plans to remove environmental protections. The coal mine that he chose to speak at was recently fined $3 million for dumping mine wastewater into tributaries of the Ohio River. So, makes sense, right? And it seems like Pruitt has a friend in Pennsylvania, as the PA Department of Environmental Protection sues two small rural towns for passing local laws banning underground disposal wells for fracking wastewater. You heard that right, folks. The EPA in Pennsylvania is suing towns because they tried to protect the environment. According to a new report from the PA Budget and Policy Center, PA taxpayers are footing the bill for teaching creationism in charter schools. It's always good. Pashi's hired consultants visit campuses now to determine how to give Chancellor Frank Brogan a green light to gut public higher education. Oh, and what's that? The first protest in space? You bet. So tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. I'll be there giving the weekly resistance report once again. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org, or you can tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or using the Free Speech TV app on Roku. If you missed the show, no worries. Go to the ricksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech TV icon in the sidebar on the right-hand side. Right? I think he posts that on Sunday or Monday, so you can check that out. And we need you, folks, to help keep Pull No Punches progressive media going strong. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $2 a month. Simply go to RagingChickenPress.org and look for the support and membership tab. Click Become a Member and you're on your way. Or become a patron on Patreon if you like. You know, we don't care. Just become a member. Not ready to become a member? Okay, we gotcha. You can make a one-time donation by clicking Donate. Right? We need you, the progressive community, to help us deepen Pull No Punches, progressive media that will hold power accountable now more than ever. So, Sean, happy Good Friday. Happy not so good Friday.
Hey, at least I hear I'll be able to build a bomb shelter now since the river's going down.
Yeah, well, you know, that's my interpretation of MOAB, man. You know, I mean, I don't know if you saw, but the Pentagon actually released the video of that explosion. I don't know if you saw it yet, but it was this morning. But man, it's freaking nuts.
I don't know how what to think about this, like with this MOAB thing. I mean, I don't know if it's like more shock and awe, more like. More of a campaign, not campaign, but more of like a press relations stunt, you know, as much as it's to get like the American media riled up, which, you know, certainly got a lot of us riled up yesterday. But you look at this thing, it's a huge bomb. It's inefficient. Like, it can't guide itself. You have to fly at a certain like low altitude to drop this thing. And so, like, what's the point of having this non-stealthy like weapon?
Well, no, I mean, I think the point of it is just mass destruction and a big boom. I mean, like, you know, if you look at, that was originally designed, right, for use in Iraq and things like this. But, you know, it's, you know, at least as they were talking about why they used this bomb in that area, because they knew that apparently they knew that the ISIS or some kind of camps were in some of the caves. They didn't know which cave. So just to wreck them all. Right. The idea was to kind of try to cave in all the caves and just trap people in there and kind of as a way of dealing with that. I mean, you know, it's pretty indiscriminate. And you don't know, I mean, it was in a remote kind of mountain area and stuff like that. But, you know, I think it's a message about, like, we are here and we are going to punish you. And these are the size of our bombs and they're coming for you. I mean, I really think that's what this is about. It's about, you know, I mean, I don't think it was just about politically signaling. I think it was about telling these people, and this is, you know, everything that Trump says, other people on the far right, that's what they care about. They want to punish, right? That's that visceral idea about destroying and killing people. And this is just a kind of another way to doing this. And the fact that that bomb has never been used before, right, in active combat, that, you know, Trump gets to put this feather in his cap.
Yeah, no, and the real reason why it hasn't been used is because the amount of destruction that it causes, the indiscriminate killing, and it's it's trying to like here we are creeping towards a potentially another war, like, you know, a couple of them actually, and it seems like everyone's just who cares?
Well, I mean,
it's not. Like, I mean, we could have a full-fledged war with North Korea by the end of the weekend, and no one will notice because it's Easter Sunday weekend.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that and then the other side of it too as well. I mean, I was talking with my wife about this last night, and I was saying that, you know, it's really kind of creepy that how our media responds to this kind of stuff. You know, it's like you start talking about, kind of American attacks and warfare and things like this. And it seems like everybody loses their, you know, critical rudder. And it's all the question of, you know, and you see the media pundits all over cable news and things like this talking about, you know, how should the attack on Syria be, or how should we go about and kind of further bomb Lebanon, and where should we use a Moab next? And as opposed to saying what's actually going on here, right? And, you know, again, I don't think you're going to find anybody who has sympathy for ISIS, right? Well, I mean, obviously there's some out there, because there wouldn't be something called ISIS, but I certainly have no kind of sympathy for them. But the direction that we're going, the trajectory that we're going is not good. I mean, I don't know if you saw this, but, you know, the night of the Tomahawk missile attack in Syria, that Americans that were, you know, special operators, I guess they're calling them now, special ops people that were in this fort on the Syrian border, working with some kind of Syrian resistance folks, Syrian resistance fighters, apparently, they were pulled from that fort as the attack was taking place, went off into the desert, right? Shortly after that, you have these kind of crack fighters from Syrian forces come forth with a car bomb, blows the front door of the fort, comes in there, guys come in with suicide vests. There's close range combat that takes place within there. A number of the Syrians that were in there were killed. Americans that are hearing out there out in the desert, they're kind of like away from this, hear this. They come in, right? They come back in to try to kind of keep the fort, they engage in kind of short range, what was by all accounts short range, kind of pretty intense combat to retake the fort and kill these other folks. I mean, where's that as the headline news? Right. I mean, you know, this is what I think about in terms of the consequences of those actions, about you're going to impact real people on the ground. Not only are we seeing the kind of, you know, increase in killing of civilians in some of these attacks, there's questionable aspects about, well, what's the effectivity of this, especially when you got the guy, you know, General Mattis, he can't even get straight whether how many planes were actually destroyed. Is it 20 planes or is it 20% of the Syrian Air Force? I mean, this was the guy who's supposed to be the steady hand in there, is coming forth and saying that kind of stuff. And now we've got this bombing, you know, out in Afghanistan, right, which is going to raise kind of, you know, alert levels even more. And then now you've got Trump kind of signaling that he's ready to go toe-to-toe and preemptively strike North Korea if they go forward with a nuclear test this weekend. I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing how much it's escalated in a matter of a week. Like, and it's, you know, I see no good things coming from this, especially if we bomb North Korea.
No, that's going to be not good at all. At all, period. Right. I mean, North Korea has said, you know, basically they have threatened to retaliate with nuclear weapons. Right. I mean, they basically have said this is where this is going to go. And again, look, you don't need to defend North Korea to recognize that this is crazy. All right. This is the other thing that drives me absolutely nuts about these conversations is like, you know, you talk with people who seem like fairly reasonable people normally as you walk through your life. And then you kind of bring up this situation in North Korea and their response is like, well, you know, I don't know why you have to defend North Korea. I'm like, what? You're telling me what? There's two choices I have. My two choices are either like,
Bomb
North Korea or defend North Korea. These are my two options. I mean, it's crazy. And I don't know if you heard that last week. And this was, you know, I found myself always going back to some of these discussions that you hear on the Majority Report, where Sam Cedar was talking about being on the Chris Hayes' All-In show the night of the bombing of Syria, and having this kind of discussion and kind of just watching the people around the table basically, you know, start asking questions about what's the appropriate military response. And he was the only one there that was saying, well, wait, why are we having a military response here? Is this the best action? And what he said was exactly what I was feeling at the time, is that this feels eerily like it did for those of us who lived during that early days of the Bush administration and who were politically active then. It feels eerily the same way, except you've got people that are kind of much more off the rails inside the Trump organization. So, you know, it's nuts.
Yeah.
So whatever, you know, I mean, like
one of the things, so I listened to The Intercept this week, Intercepted.
Yeah, yeah.
With
Jeremy Scahill,
which who I give a lot of authority to on this issue because of the books he's written, and he spent a large amount of his career writing about the stuff happening in the Middle East. So he's kind of like my go-to authority figure on that. And he had Dennis Kucinich on. And, you know, like you could say what you want about Kucinich, but Kucinich was making a good point for saying, well, what, like he was making the argument that he believes that Syria did not gas their own people. Right. Which you got to take that with a grain of salt, obviously. But he's saying, why would they do that just to provoke a response when they have the upper hand in this war that's going on? They've had this upper hand for a while. And he would think that it's an act of desperation to start using gas weapons, but
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But he was sort of defending Tulsi Gabbard in this, and
yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I look at it like this, and like again, if I see,
I'm still. Like,
that, I mean, I look at it like this. I mean, if you look at the people who were on the ground, the first people who were on the ground, I think it was what AFP, Agence France-Presse or something like this. I was the first on the ground, or maybe it was the BBC. I can't remember who was first there, who got there after the attacks and said like what they saw, what they were claiming there was a silo where there's a cache of chemicals or something like this on the ground, was a silo that had been abandoned, was clearly not just destroyed, but it had been destroyed for a long time. And according to people, longtime residents there was nothing like that going on there. This could very easily be also, I mean, because you remember, I mean, this is not the first time this has gone on, right? I mean, you saw the gassing, Assad gassing people before. I understand the skepticism, right? And I understand like wanting to make sure that this is not just being used as the false flag operation, as you get a lot of people that are talking about. But
we're not a false flag, but like a drum beat into war as an excuse of going into war, like on the American side. I think like that's where he was coming from, like skepticism. I'm still skeptical of like what we should do in Syria. I don't believe we should go to war. Like I've had that stance even since Obama was in office. Like we should not, no military intervention in Syria whatsoever, because it's just going to destabilize the region even further. And it's,
I mean, the hard work around me in my mind is like, okay, what are the terms of going, of engaging with this in Syria? Right. I mean, I'm not even saying that that there shouldn't be some sort of kind of response. But again, this gets back to the question of how we do international affairs. I mean, is this just, you know, again, like I said last week when we talked about this, it's like, you know, I think Trump, the reason why he did this, he's like, he saw this stuff and he felt that if he didn't respond, he was going to feel impotent and that he was going to look bad. And so therefore he needed a bomb. I mean, I really think that was the terms. And of course there were people that were feeding him because they knew that they wanted it, people with their own agendas. Right. But but why, right? The big picture,
I look at this and Trump's latest thing, like him just being a toddler in a sandbox playing with his toys.
Yeah, well, it's looking.
Let's see what this button goes boom. Like,
well, I mean, yeah, especially you have to hear him. That, you know, the journalists asking about the Moab, like, you know, use of the Moab, that massive bomb, and they're kind of, you know, asking, well, did you authorize that? And he kind of gave this answer that was like, yeah, well, my military, yeah, the military, we have the best military in the world, and I authorize them, right? Like, wait, what? Did you give the order to drop this bomb? Did you approve this? Or did you just basically, you know, outsource this to whatever general wants to go with this? I mean, did you just take a hands-off approach and said, go get them, we'll do whatever you want? I mean, that's scary by itself, right? So, I mean, you know, there's a reason why we're supposed to have civilian control of our military, right? I mean, that's kind of part of the deal. And so hearing his response was kind of like, really, man? So who's minding the store, right? I mean, get your hand out of the candy jar, right? Get your head in the game. But I don't know, you know, but I think, you know, again, this is the fact that, you know, I think, you know, because so many Americans don't pay attention to this stuff, right? Don't pay attention to national relations. And because there's so few of our, you know, of citizens actually serve in the military, that, you know, we don't have that daily connection with a lot of folks that are involved in this. So for most, I think, Americans, these are kind of abstract war games that they see on TV, and not really thinking about some of the really concrete consequences of what's moving forward.
Yeah.
So I don't know. So, we'll keep an eye on this. He's like, you know, especially this weekend. So we'll see if we're still here on this planet next week, if the bombing of North Korea goes awry, we'll kind of see what happens with that. But, you know, here statewide, right, just to get inside the, you know, the craziness of once again of the Trump organization, you know, we got news this week, for example, that Betsy DeVos, right, has got a special security detail. They're spending about $8 million to have federal marshals protect her. And I guess that order got made to give her special protection after she went to that. She was going to that school and people protested her. And apparently she got so afraid that now they got federal marshals. You know, $8 million for 8 months, I guess, is the way the contract is working. And meanwhile, in the next step, she basically takes away protections for students who've taken out student loans. I mean, there you go, there she is.
And then, did you see that down in Mar-a-Lago, Palm Beach, whatever, down there, the local county is looking to raise its own taxes, because to protect, to pay for the expenses that Trump brings with him every time he goes down to his golf resort.
Yeah, he goes around to relax for the weekend and doesn't think twice about the fact that it's costing millions and millions of dollars just to kind of do the security perimeter and everything. It's nuts. I mean, these people are bleeding money. I mean, they're actually bleeding money. And what, you know, was interesting, I talked about last week, I've been reading this book, Dark Money by Jane Mayer, and DeVos has got a history of this kind of stuff. Of thinking people are out to get her, and having private security around her, and all.
So she's paranoid.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the other thing that was interesting, when I was looking into some of the stuff that she was, you know, pulling away these protections. I mean, the protections that Obama put in place for student loans, students who had taken out student loans, was basically wanting some normalization of basically the code of ethics for people, these services, the outsourced services who basically are collecting loan payments, because they were all over the map. They were giving students wrong information. They were, you know, not telling them about ways to reduce their payments, whole bunch of problems. So Obama put in these rules that basically say, look, if you're going to do this for us, for the federal government, you need to meet these standards, right? As a way of transparency with borrowers, and a way to make sure that students were protected. So DeVos is pulling that away. So it turns out that this came out when she was going through the hearings. She has connections to multiple companies of these loan servicers, right? So she's bunchy. This came out during the hearings, and there was a bunch of articles about this. So she is actually financially vested. She's making decisions and pulling these regulations for companies that she has direct monetary interest in. I mean, I was like, oh my God. So not only is this like, you know, hey, let's screw the students, we're also, she might profit off it personally because of it.
It's a kleptocracy, and this kleptocracy is going to be a lot worse than what Bush had in office.
Oh my God. Yeah.
This administration is going to be nothing but about self-enrichment, and that's what's happening right now.
No, I mean, I think that's absolutely the case, and it's sad that it's there. And then we have, okay, so we've got Betsy DeVos, and now we find out that Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign advisor for a while there, I mean, you know, basically came on board to kind of get an agenda passed, right? I mean, he was successful in lobbying to get, you know, the Republican Party platform's language on Ukraine changed. But now, apparently, in contact and discussions with the FBI and CIA, somebody's alerting them that, you know, you really should have basically declared yourself to be an agent of a foreign government. So now he's doing that retroactively, right? Which is the same thing that what's his face? So I'm forgetting his name.
Mike Flynn,
where same thing that he had to do with Turkey, right? So I'm thinking about this. How is it allowable to let these people do this retroactively? Why are they not being prosecuted? You know what I mean? And the only thing I could think of is that, you know, that you got a case is being made here to get these people to testify and say what they know.
Yeah. And one of the things about Manafort has had, I mean, he's been a Republican operative for what, the past 20 or 30 years. He's been working in all the administrations, Bush 1, Bush 2,
yep.
Reagan. All your last three major Republican administrations, Manafort was there working, and he was also working on behalf of, you know, dictators around the world, groups like Russia and other parts of the country, or other parts of, like, you know, other parts of Africa and Europe. And so, like, this isn't surprising that he's been doing this. I mean, this is his playbook. This is what he's been doing for the past 20 or 30 years. And really, that's not the narrative that's been. People seem surprised about this.
No, I know, and it's great.
When you look back in his client list and all the brutal dictators that he has represented over the past 30 years.
Right, he has that history of representing the absolute worst of the worst. I mean, there's no way around it. And then, you know, this right now is like, for a long time, he's been publicly denying that, you know, there was that ledger that came out that was found in Ukraine after the dictatorship was toppled. They look at the ledger, they saw all these payments to Manafort. Manafort says, this is a fake. This is not happening. Never received it. He was forced to admit just this week that no, actually he had received at least some of that money. And by some of that money, we're talking like in millions of dollars. So, you know, and I think that's whatever evidence they had to put them over the edge. I think that was part of it, that now he's, you have to register as a foreign government. I still don't see what I can't see the big game here yet, unless, you know, but it seems like they're kind of closing in on the Trump administration. Because like we're saying, once this week too as well, we see, our favorite punching bag, Carter Page, in the news again. Like, the fact that this guy is even, you know, a thing is remarkable to me, because he can barely even answer questions or anything. But once again, we found out this week that there was a FISA warrant issued for him last summer.
Oh yeah, my phones, they were tapped. I was making all these out of area code phone calls.
Oh, I don't know. I don't see what the problem was. I was just like, I had this information and they asked me for it and they said they'd give me money for it. So I gave it to them. What's the problem with that? I'm like, I don't know. This is going to be nuts. But, you know, and apparently it was a pretty big deal that the fact that somebody leaked that about FISA warrants, because that doesn't happen. So,
oh yeah, we also Nunes is off of the investigation. Was that this week or last week?
I think that was last week. I think that was. I don't know if it happened before a podcast. Well, I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah, because they pulled them off. Oh yeah, we talked about. Yeah, that's right. We talked about Ryan. How Ryan was like, oh, you know, he did so well, and you know, I trust him fully. But blah blah blah. Craziness. So then what else we got Neil Gorsuch. This on Monday was sworn into the Supreme Court. So now today, I guess on Fridays, there's a closed session to review, I think it's 11 or 13 cases that are still before the court. And one of those cases is going to be around voting rights. So you know, there's some other ones that I guess on kind of religious protections and this kind of stuff. The voting rights issue is going to be potentially big, right? Because this case is in regarding North Carolina's decision to basically to strike down North Carolina's voting rights, or, you know, really racist voting rights laws, attempts to kind of suppress the vote. And a court had struck that down, and now that's going to the Supreme Court to see if those protections or quote unquote that law was kind of legitimate protection or something. And now Gorsuch is going to be basically has the potential to tip that court in the direction of kind of, nope, keeping those voting restrictions in place as we move into an election cycle. It does not look good.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't even know, man. Did you catch Sessions this week?
I did not. I heard a little bit about it.
Holy moly. So he goes down to Nogales, right? Right on the border. It's like right in the area.
I heard he was having like a cross burning or something. Was that true?
Yeah. Well, you know, he did. No, before he got to the cameras, he took the hood off. Right. So we don't have direct evidence that the cross was burned and that he was wearing the Klan outfit. But there were some eyewitnesses there that no, we don't. But it was basically what it was. Right. He went down there with a head full of steam of white nationalism to basically take the stand on the border. Right. It was kind of like this Alamo kind of moment. It was a weird kind of performance. It was right around the location that you had a Catholic bishop who had gone down there to give communion through the fence, and this kind of like this of unity. It comes right back to that point. And in his prepared remarks, he basically said that we are coming here to the border, right, to take our stand against the filth, right? The filth is what he's referring to. And again, he's talking about kind of, you know, immigration, kind of clamp down, kind of sending people back and all this kind of stuff. So in his prepared remarks, he was there to say the filth. Now, when he actually delivered them, he got to that point, we're going to take our stand. And he kind of stammers, right? You can see he's looking at the words and decides not to say them, right? But it was there in his prepared remarks that were released. And it's like, and this is the second time, at least the second time in the past week where this kind of thing has happened. He's had language in his speeches, right, that are right out of white nationalist playbooks, right? And he's kind of glossed them over or kind of changed them suddenly when he actually came to speak them. So the real question here is like how much, you know, who are the people in that crew that are writing those things, right? Is it Sessions himself and he's just kind of like backing out and he's thinking maybe it's not the best idea that I say these things in public? Or is he kind of, you know, his speechwriters are putting this stuff together and he's showing up and he's kind of, you know, oh, wait, maybe this is not a good idea, which then, you know, begs a question, like who's the freaking Nazis writing the speeches, you know?
Come on, guys, it can't be that overt.
No, I mean, like, yeah, he's like, you know,
walked right into that one.
Like, yep. We're here to take a stand against the filth and clean them with our white sheets. You know, he's decided no, he's not going to do that.
So, talking about like, you know, white supremacists, white nationalists, neo Nazis, and everything. Did you see, Richard Spencer was back in the news this week.
Yeah, I heard he got hit again.
He got glitter bombed too.
He got glitter bombed too. Uh oh, he's got fairy dust on him now. And what's happened?
So it ended up happening, you know, supposedly like he was insulting the taxi driver and it was like the scene out of the Big Lebowski where the driver pulled over to the side of the road and kicked him out of the taxi and told him to get out.
That's awesome.
And he had to go back into the crowd and just punched him in the face for a second time. And then Brett, you know, our friend Brett Banatelli made it on national news again with his, he had a tweet as you know, like linking back to his tweet, like, you know, 3 months ago, I made a remix of, you know, Richard Spencer getting punched in the face. Here's a GIF of him getting glitter bombed.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I had we still got some of those pins left too, as well. The Richard Spencer project, right? with the big fist like this. So I think they're going to be, you know, what's old is new again. Right? It's the gift that keeps on giving, man. I'll tell you, it's so crazy. All right. So listen, we're coming up to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about, you know, some stuff a little bit closer home here in Pennsylvania. You know, not necessarily any happier, but pretty interesting. So we'll be back right after this break with the craziness of Pennsylvania. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. See you in a minute.
Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1975. That was the day union representatives at Bunker Hill Mining Company in Kellogg, Idaho, were notified of a policy change. The lead and zinc producer had decided to exclude fertile women from working in lead-exposed environments. Women workers had to provide a doctor's note stating they were infertile, postmenopausal, or had been sterilized. Otherwise, they would be transferred to safer departments at a substantial loss in pay. 29 women took the transfer, while at least three opted for sterilization. During World War II, companies like Bunker Hill promised millions of women workers that they would eliminate hazards through engineering controls. In the 1970s, a new wave of women gained work in several industries that used occupational safety language to implement exclusionary policies like the one at Bunker Hill. These took the form of outright bans on hiring of women, either altogether or in many departments considered too toxic for women of childbearing years. It meant the real loss of well over 100,000 potential industrial jobs for women. Employers could have provided actual protection through better medical coverage and benefits, installation of engineering controls, or protections to include men's reproductive health. Instead, these policies served to roll back economic and civil rights of women workers, regardless of whether they were mothers or ever planned to be. The women appealed to their union, state and federal commissions, and OSHA, but faced an uphill battle. OSHA initially fined Bunker Hill for outstanding violations and its sterilization policy, but dropped the case once Ronald Reagan took office. The women eventually won wage equivalency in their new jobs, but women working in heavy industry would continue to battle such policies for more than a decade.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. And before we get into this segment, I just want to say, because I know that she generally listens to this podcast, I want to give a shout out to my friend Colleen. Colleen was our office manager, ABSCoff office manager at Kutztown University. Just one of the most kind of amazing, raging organizers and political thinkers and stuff that's out there. And she's going to be leaving us for a much better situation, a much better job, and where she's going to actually have even a greater impact. She's going to stay in the area. But this is a huge shout out to Colleen, and thank you for everything that you've done. I know locally at Kutztown, we could not have pulled off the energy of the strike that we did in the fall without the work that she did, the amazing skills that she brought to that game that filled, you know, skills that we didn't even know we needed. She's absolutely amazing. So best of luck to you, Colleen. I'm going to be seeing you still up there because she's going to be based out of Allentown now. So kudos to you. All right. So one of the things I didn't get a chance to mention before we went to break, and I just want to make sure this gets in because this is important. Also, we saw this past week, Trump signed, and this is one of these bills, right? You know, he loves to go out and sign these bills with his big signature in public in front of the cameras and things like this. But this is one of these ones that he did behind closed doors, right? You know, and I think that, you know, Women's History Month is over now, so now we can get down to attacking women now again. Because basically he signs this bill that allows states to strip federal family planning funds from abortion providers, right? Now, this is different than money going to, you know, to groups that you hear all this kind of stuff Republicans say. It's already true, the fact. It's already true that federal funds can't go to abortion services, right? This is one step further than that. So they're saying if your organization, right, offers abortion services, then we don't have to give you money, right? That's different than saying you have money to go directly to abortions. So obviously this is something that's another way to directly attack Planned Parenthood. There's another way to attack women's clinics and providing healthcare. Now that could amount to, you know, we're talking 4 million women at least, rely upon these services, not just for abortions, right? As much as these people want you to think this, right? But for daily medical protection. So, you know, the fight's gearing up, folks, once again, and we're going to see what happens with this. My guess is going to be we're going to see some challenge of this is in court. But this is going to be once again going to reinvigorate part of the movement to make sure that, you know, Planned Parenthood and several other groups are going to be continue to be able to provide medical care for women. So pay attention to this stuff. So as the MOABs are dropping, so are our rights. So take a look at that. So anyways, so there's that. And then we have to stay closer to home here in PA. Well, you know, that's as close as you get. I mean, you get right here, but still, we've got Scott Pruitt, right? He is the, if you remember, he's the anti-EPA director of the EPA, you know, the guy who basically has been suing the EPA for years, guy from Oklahoma, now who's the head of the EPA, wants to destroy the EPA, which is whatever. That's its own little mind by itself. But he was in PA yesterday and he was there to talk about, went to a coal mine, right? To talk to, you know, talk it up with the workers and stuff like this, and to announce his plans basically to remove environmental protections. And, you know, so he comes to the state, goes to this mine, and, you know, the mine in question or the company in question who runs the mine has actually been fined recently $3 million for dumping mine wastewater into tributaries of the Ohio River. And this is the kind of company that he keeps, you know. I mean, he comes up here and basically says that these are the people that we're going to support. We're going to support organizations or companies like this coal company who basically pollute, and we're going to take it off. This is called it was the Harvey Mine, and it's run by Consol Energy. Sorry, I was just looking for that as we were talking. Consol Energy is going to be very, very happy with this. So, but it seemed fitting that was going to happen at the same time that we see, and this just blew my mind, Sean, is like, we have the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection is suing two small rural towns because they put something into their home rule charters that basically said, we are not going to have, frack water injected into our ground and storage areas. We're not going to have disposal wells, in our state, precisely because we see not only has it contaminated water in the past, but as we've seen in Oklahoma, we saw increasing earthquakes as a result of this kind of practice. So, I mean, I don't know what kind of world we live in when we have the Environmental Protection Agency is suing two small towns for protecting the environment. I don't know, man.
No. And that falls squarely on the shoulders of Governor Wolf, that lawsuit right there.
Mm-hmm.
It that falls squarely on the shoulders of Governor Wolf. And it shows you that, you know, we have a governor here in Pennsylvania who, you know, who wants to keep the status quo. I mean, you know, you look at it like this, Pennsylvania, you know, for most of its history has been a resource extraction colony for timber, for coal, for oil, now for gas. And, you know, the governor is making sure that Pennsylvania stays the resource extraction colony that we've been for the past 100, 200 years. And to further that, I mean, that's basically what we are right now we're a resource extraction colony pretty much. And we get none of the benefits of those resources getting extracted, and Governor Wolf is continuing the status quo on that.
Yeah,
and for that's his biggest. I think that's one of his biggest failures.
Oh, I no doubt. I mean, no doubt. I mean, all the research. I mean, I know that Keystone Research Center has done stuff on this about, you know, what are the kind of long term impacts of job creation, because that's how they love to talk about this, is job creation. And it shows that the long term job creation is negligible. You have some initial upticks when you're talking about laying some of the pipelines and some of the initial drilling. But all the rest of that is basically have minimal monitoring jobs and so on. There's also there's nothing in any of the legislation that's basically saying you have to employ people from Pennsylvania. So I remember being up in kind of shale country and kind of watching all of a sudden when we got the, you know, huge kind of fracking boom that was going on in Pennsylvania, you're seeing all the plates from Texas, from Oklahoma, from North Dakota and all this. And you're like, well, why aren't you hiring people right in Pennsylvania at the very least if you're going to impact their areas? But no. So, you know, this has been incredible. And like you said, is that not only is it just kind of whole hog extractivism here, we're also seeing that there's no benefit back. So we're the only state, right, that is allowing this kind of stuff that has no basically tax on the drillers. And so, I mean, it's like, what are we getting out of this, right, other than long-term damage to our communities, our natural resources, and our drinking water?
Yeah, I mean, we've had, like, for going over the past 100 years, you know, you go to some of those you go to some of the conservancies outside of Kutztown, towards the Appalachian Trail, you know, like that forest is second growth forest that was all strip cut down from before timber. You know, we didn't learn the lessons from that. We didn't learn the lessons from the acid mine drainage that we're still dealing with, that the coal industry is left behind, you know, or with the oil and coal. And now we're doing this, making the same mistakes for what? For boom bust cycles in the economy, it does absolutely nothing. I mean, we are the we are pretty much West Virginia.
Yep. Well, we're dragging West Virginia down as it goes. I mean, this is what Rick Smith always says, right? We're dragging West Virginia down, right? Because even West Virginia, right, has an extraction tax, right? And I don't even know what to do with this. You know, I look at Governor Wolf, and, you know, we've talked about this before. I don't know what kind of game he's playing. I mean, I don't think he's that dumb to know that the impact on the environment is greater than anything that we're going to get out of this, that there's going to be minimal job creation. I don't think he's dumb enough to not believe that. He's playing some kind of game with wanting to get
It's him. Where, you know, he's a friend of Ed Rendell. So he staffed himself with a bunch of Ed Rendell advisors.
Exactly. Yep.
He has an Ed Rendell person running the state Democratic Party and Marcel Groen. You know, these people are part of the Steny Hoyer, Chuck Schumer, Third Way, DLC Democratic Party that's been around in this state and around the country for the past 20 or 30 years. And they're walking dinosaurs. They're remnants of the past. Like they don't represent the future of the Democratic Party, but they're still here and we still have to deal with them. And that's the people that, you know, that's the people that Wolf has sided himself with, you know, everyone from the Rendell administration, you know, Katie McGinty, someone from the Rendell administration, you know, Mary Eisenhower, who is now his chief of staff, someone, a holdover from the Rendell administration, you know, Hanger was from the Rendell administration, but Hanger, you know, did some good things while he was the EPA. You know, he did try, you could say that, but, you know, he staffed himself with people from the Rendell administration, and that's who's advising him. You know, the people like Eisenhower, the people like Marcel Groen, you know, all these corporate Democrats that are running the party, running the show. And, you know, where do they fall in line? I mean, Rendell has contracts with, you know, I think he's a lobbyist for some of the gas industry stuff, right? Steve Horn has written about, Katie McGinty being a working with, you know, Transamerica and stuff like that.
Yep.
You know, it's
no. And I think, you know, I look at this and, you know, it makes no sense. It makes no sense in terms of job impacts. It makes no sense in terms of revenue for the state. It makes no sense in terms of
the DEP, you know, right now is staffed at like 1994 levels.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, no, exactly. I mean, it's like, but I mean, the policy makes no sense ever. And the worst part about it doesn't even make political sense, right? I mean, you can make an argument that, okay, maybe this is going to help him out a little politically, but that is not where the energy in the Democratic Party is. I mean, as we see what's been going on, I mean, you know, we have, for example, you know, we didn't talk about this in the first segment, but this is a perfect example of this, like nationally, is that the energy of the Democratic Party is in the progressive grassroots.
And I don't know
who he thinks he's going to mobilize right behind him for this, for his reelection campaign, when he's basically telling all the activists, like all the people that are going to go, that would potentially go out and mobilize behind him, right, to say that, you know, no, screw you, we're going to kind of destroy the environment, we don't care what you have to say, because I'm in the pocket of big business like everyone else. So like, that's going to drive some people away from the polls, or it's going to put a primary challenger, which I actually would like to see.
And you know, it's one of the funny things, this week, that, you know, we didn't have the planning to talk about it, but something very strange happened in New York State this week. You know, the progressive, you know, stalwart of the Democratic Party, Andrew Cuomo. Oh, wait, he's not a progressive. But
wait, I thought he was a socialist.
I thought he was a Republican. But like, you know, the very centrist
socialist Republican.
That's what we call a Nazi. No, but you know, this week, the very centrist, very moderate leaning Democrat Andrew Cuomo got free college higher education, free higher ed tuition for the public schools in New York State for anyone that goes to those schools. First state in the country to do this. And yep. Where did it start? It started with the Sanders campaign and the Sanders platform.
Absolutely. So let me a couple things like that. I can't believe we didn't put this in the rundown to begin with, because this has been one of the hugest victories of this past week. And you know, I talked about this at the Resistance Report and the Rick Smith Show that'll be tomorrow night. But that is huge. Now, you know, here's the thing, right? Progressives have. You see this, a lot of the stuff online, right, have kind of come after this, because there's a whole bunch of caveats to that free tuition, right? Your family has to make less than, $125,000 per year. You still have to apply for federal aid, right? And these scholarships, the Excelsior scholarship, what this policy is, basically makes up whatever the federal aid doesn't cover, right? It doesn't cover housing, doesn't cover books and things like this. So there's still going to be disproportional impacts, disproportionate costs for poor and working class families, right? However, right, saying all of that, right? So yes, there's all those caveats out there, right? But this is a huge step forward for exactly what you said. I mean, I can't believe that we're seeing this. Now, again, Cuomo, other people are sniping at Cuomo being like, you know, he's just positioning himself for a 2020 run. Who cares, right? Just because you've put together, you know, of course he's positioning himself for this. Of course he's a politician. I mean, what do people expect? It drives me insane. But I mean, like, here you've got an opportunity where actually people in the grassroots, people from the Sanders campaign, have so far affected the agenda and pushed that milestone forward that we have a state that is basically returning to a way of thinking about public education, which is about an investment in the future. It's incredible. I'm so glad you brought this up, Sean, because this was an enormous victory this week.
Yeah. And so one of the things is, the Cuomo plan similar to the Clinton plan or no?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so it is similar to the Clinton plan.
It's similar to the Clinton plan, right? But let you know, we put this in play, right? It's like, it's very similar.
The way I listen to this, right? The framing and the messaging that came out of this was that this is free public higher ed, right? I wasn't able to like look into it, you know, been busy working and stuff like this. But the way, so the Cuomo campaign framed this as free public higher ed, right?
Yep.
Which is what the Sanders campaign framed their plan as, right? But when Clinton was campaigning in Harrisburg, Bill Clinton, that is, we go back to this every time. He spent 20 minutes, you know, chastising students supporting Sanders' free higher education plan. And he used that same type of frame. And he's like, no, we need market-based solutions. And yeah, given the problems with Cuomo and everything, at least they had the wherewithal to frame it in that, say, hey, this is free public higher education for X amount of people.
I mean, let's look at Cuomo for a second, right? And you know, Cuomo is actually a really good study for what I think that for what progressives should be looking at, right? And here's what I mean by that, is that everything, you know, look, Cuomo is no progressive, right? He is no progressive. He's gone after public education. He's a whole bunch of stuff like this. There's a whole lot of reasons not to like him as like an individual abstracted from history.
And there, right? there's fights with him going back for the past 3 or 4 years about people he had pointed to the Education Commission. Absolutely. And their involvement with charter schools. You know, this Absolutely. Is a fight that's been going on for about 3 or 4 years now too.
Absolutely. So there's lots of reasons not to like him as an individual abstracted from history and context, right? But here's what you have. New York State, right? Two huge victories, right, from the grassroots. Number one, fracking ban, right? New York State, you cross the border from Pennsylvania into New York State, and it's a different world, right? You no longer have the gas flares. You no longer have the pipeline. You no longer have the destruction of the environment. You have, like, all that land where the shale is. It gets its name from frickin' Marcellus, like, up in Syracuse, just west of or east of Syracuse, right? The fracking ban. Where did that come from? Was it because Cuomo was like, you know, all like lefty? No, it's because the pressure that was put on him, right, affected him and moved him in that direction, forced him to basically say, okay, we're going to go out and study this, right? That was his first like, okay, well, we'll study this, and studied it, and frankly did a good study and came back and looked at the results. It's like, okay, yeah, all right, I'm convinced.
It's so not good.
this is not good, right? And he also recognizes that you've got people on his left flank, right? Like Zephyr Teachout, right, was putting pressure on him at that point, on his left flank, and he recognizes where the power and the pressure is, and he was moved to that position, just like this, right? He would not have offered this by himself had it not been from the pressure of the Sanders campaign and the education activists that continued to put pressure on him, right? So this is like huge. So there's your model, right? If you got a politician who is responsive, who has to be responsive to a constituency, it's our job to be that active, in-your-face constituency that they cannot turn away from. And these are the results, right? Yes, they're not perfect, right? But the fact, exactly as you said, that he framed this as free public higher education, you realize where that puts us? Now that's part of the discourse. Now that's a place to move. Right now, it's a place to kind of push even further. So and I'm waiting for that next shoe to drop.
And this isn't the pay it forward model that progressives have been going after for the past 3 or 4 years. You know, pay it forward's been something that's been talked about for what, the past 5 or 6 years now.
Yep.
And have been is I don't believe any states on the West Coast do it, but that's where they were actively pushing it. Right.
No, they do it in Oregon.
Okay, so Oregon does have it,
or is it Washington? Is it Oregon? I think it's Oregon.
It's Oregon or Washington, one of those two states, but. It's something completely different than that. You're not paying it back.
Right. And even we should say, even the pay it forward model, right? I mean, as many of their problems with that, the victory there was, right? I mean, you know, again, what the pay it forward basically targets debt, right? Long-term debt. And basically says, you're not going to be required to go into like private bank debt like you would with student loans. So that you're going to pay it back, but you're going to pay it back based upon your income, right? And only for a limited period of time. So again, that moves things forward in one kind of direction. This one, however, again, right back to your point, right? Talk about the language here is not like how to make it more affordable or how to get a lower debt. No, let's talk about free public higher education. That's huge.
Yeah.
That's huge. But, you know, meanwhile, you know, I'll use that as kind of here's that kind of contrasting point. So meanwhile, right now, this coming week, well, actually, it's already happening. You've got Pashi has hired consultants, right, to go to campus by campus and basically talk to faculty and students and administrators and things like this to put a report to bring back to the administration, as recommendations for destroying the universities, I guess, you know. And again, this organization that is out in front of it, they're called the National Center for Higher Education Management
and
Systems.
Where's the Wolf administration in on this issue too?
Dude, he's silent. He is silent. Now, look, our state, ABSCUF statewide president, right, has been meeting with the Wolf administration and things like this, but I haven't heard a peep from the governor in public about defending this stuff, right? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, and as far as most members that I know of that I work with on a daily basis, like, we feel like we've been betrayed by this governor. We feel like that we've been left out in the cold by this governor after we stepped out and we were the first union, right, to get behind him and supported him in his election campaign. And he made a firm commitment to public education, public K-12 and higher education here. I have not seen him that. I have not seen him do this. Yes, he's proposed increases in the budget and things like that. That is so fundamentally different than actually being an advocate for public higher education. And meanwhile, we're seeing five universities that are under the act have been given notice for possible retrenchment. We're seeing the slow burn retrenchment at places like Kutztown, where I teach, where they're gutting faculty members. They're cutting people moving from full-time to part-time. They're eliminating particular courses. We were just asked, we found this out yesterday. We found out that the president of the university has asked all the divisions of the university to put together plans for a 1% cut, a 3% cut, and a 5% cut. And so basically asking people to basically, you know, decide who lives and who dies. And then so we can choose based upon this. But if you notice that, there is no put together a plan for zero cuts or plus one increase in funding. We're already going to be facing cuts that are going to be going down. So what we're seeing right now in terms of those five universities retrenchment is only the beginning in my mind. And we go into that. That's going to be happening going into an election season, right? That's going to be the governor election season and the beginning of a contract negotiation once again. This is not good.
You know what the sad thing in all of this is?
Tell me.
You know, yesterday, well, it's actually a good thing. The Auditor General, Eugene Di Pasquale, mm-hmm. Called out the State General Assembly, which for something I did not know, he threw a press conference together real quickly. Basically, the General Assembly, the legislature, has an 118 $15 million budget surplus. And he's calling for an audit of that surplus.
Good for him, man.
And they're, you know, like some of the reasons why he thinks they have such a high surplus is, you know, he believes everyone should have a rainy day fund, right? He's like, yes, everyone should have a rainy day fund. You should tap into it. But how come you don't have a separate account for, say, a protracted budget fight? Why do you have $120 million budget surplus right now instead of put that just sitting around in your person, your institutional general fund? He doesn't have the power to audit that, but he's asking for an audit of that. And boy, where would that $118 million be good at? You know, since Republicans are talking about slashing and burning everything with this budget proposal they just sent to the Senate, you know, like how come that money's not being attacked?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it's like the playbook of we saw after the financial collapse, right? That Wall Street did. It's the idea they figured, look, okay, what we're going to do is we're just going to sit on a bunch of money, right? Wall Street sat on $2 trillion, right? And just didn't do anything with it. If you take that money out of circulation, you take those resources like out of the game, right? It puts even further pressure on already pressurized institutions. And so, I mean, that's how I look at it. I'm like, look, they're sitting on this money to make things worse for people so that people believe they're garbage about having to kind of like, you know, cut those services that they require. I mean, it's not good. I hope that audit goes through.
Yeah, it would definitely be pretty interesting.
Yeah. And so meanwhile, I think he's got to get himself over to take a look at some of the charter school funding once again. I mean, I know he's been paying a lot of attention to this, but there's been a new report you were telling me before we got on the air from PA Budget and Policy Center on charter schools.
Yes, there's a report tracking the EIT tax credit, educational income, whatever, that EIT tax credit, and then the OSTC, which I believe is one of the opportunity scholarship funds. Mm-hmm. I believe that is the voucher program here in Pennsylvania, okay. The OSTC or whatever. Basically, they tracked where that money was going, and most of that money, shockingly enough, went to schools that potentially teaches creationism. You know, millions of dollars of taxpayer money from these programs are being funneled to schools that are potentially teaching, you know, young earth creationism and Bible as literal science and history.
Great. So I guess happy Good Friday, man. I mean, you know, at least brought some more eggs this year, I guess.
Well, you know, Jesus is coming back in 2 days.
Yeah.
For 3 days.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and I think that, but I, you know, I think he's going to come back down and he's going to be like, what are you people doing? Right. What are you people doing? Like
opens the door, closes it.
Can we talk about not using my name in vain? Like, look what you people are doing. This is craziness. This is not that hard, people. Right. Be good to each other. Take care of each other. Heal each other. Why is this hard? I'm telling you. He said, you guys are doing everything you can to hurt one another. I don't get it. You can just see that. Yeah. Oh, so, my God.
That was a nice report that came out this week or last week from Pennsylvania Budget Policy Center.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, and here's the stats on it, right? I mean, we're looking at the two programs, the ones you kind of mentioned, right? The Opportunity Scholarship Program and the Educational Improvement Tax Credit, about $125 million in taxpayer-funded vouchers to attend religious or other private schools. And so, you know, basically that you have taxpayer money going directly to help fund and kind of support, you know, religious teachings. And that's, I don't know, man. I'm just telling you. And I know I just don't know what to say about
Pennsylvania.
That.
For those of you who are not from Pennsylvania and are listening to the podcast, welcome to PA.
Yeah, welcome to PA. The PA. I had a conversation with a friend from DC when I was out in Portland, and you know she's got kids and things like this too as well. And she was telling me that you know how her kids had opted out of the I was talking to my friend with DC later. I was talking to my friend from Chicago, right? So same thing. It was the same conversation in two different ways. But first with my friend from Chicago and she said, you know, about opting her kids out, right? Her daughter is opting out of those tests and things like this. And I said, oh yes, I can't imagine my kids taking those things. And I said, but you know, in Pennsylvania, the only way you do this is, you know, you have to do a file religious exemption. And her literally, she nearly dropped her glass. right? And she's like staring at me like, that's not, she thought I was joking. She's like, that's not real, right? That's not real. And I'm like, no, that's real. And I told her what the process was. She's like, oh, are you kidding me? He's like, in Chicago, like we go and, or she goes to her school and she says, I'm not taking this test. And so she has to bring something to read while she's taking the test. Like, no, here in Pennsylvania, you have to kind of, you know, like you have to prove,
you have to come up with some excuse.
You have to bring your church records, you know? It's like, you know, I mean, it's that is the state that we're in. It's got a disproportional power on how things happen here. It's not very good. So I don't know, man. It just seems there's so much going on. It's like this kind of stuff is just not good. And trepidation or something like. I mean, I feel the dark cloud of this coming year. I mean, and I worry about this when we look at how far we have to go to kind of build a strong kind of resistance movement. And is there going to be enough time, you know, before everything gets sold off? I mean, we're still waiting in the wings for the right to work legislation to come forward. I imagine that it's going to start, the budget season is kind of creeping up close right now, that we're going to start seeing some of that craziness take place. And you've got a Democratic Party, at least at the statewide level, that is ill-prepared and unwilling, really, to do combat. And I don't know. I'm worried.
The thing is, I like, it's, you know, we're talking. It's a conversation Roxbury and I have a lot. You know, like, how come it's amazing, you know, seeing this stuff up front, being right down the street from the Capitol. It's amazing that like other. With Washington and New York being so close to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
It's amazing that the journalists in these beltways don't see the tidal wave that's coming into Pennsylvania.
No.
I feel like we're screaming into like the abyss to like get people to pay attention to what's happening here in Pennsylvania. Because in all honesty, you know, I'm not hopeful of Governor Wolf's reelection efforts.
No.
You know, like, this is basically going to be a status quo election or a wave election for the Republicans. And they're finally going to finish off the job they started back in 2010. And, you know, this is potentially being one of the most expensive governor's races in United States history. And we're going to have one of the most expensive Senate races in United States history with Casey getting reelected. I mean, the next year and a half here in Pennsylvania is going to be really, It's going to be scary. You know, some of the things I see personally in the Capitol, there are the Americans for Prosperity people. They've kind of been quiet for the past year. They've been in the Capitol full force at all these events, all these rallies. You see the same, lobbyists from the Americans for Prosperity. You know, people, you know, the media members treat them cordially, but no, these are people set to destroy and slash and burn. You know, like these, and you see them, they're getting a lot more active within the Capitol. We're getting a lot more active with throwing press conferences, going after Casey, going after Wolf on issues. You know, you're going to see a lot more of a vocal presence coming from the Americans for Prosperity and other groups over the next year. And the Pennsylvania is going to be a targeted state over the next, up until the next primary cycle and general election.
Oh, they're already talking about this. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, they know that Pennsylvania is, I mean, this was Pennsylvania figured squarely in the whole kind of red map, and they're like the red map program about gerrymandering and in the 2010. I mean, we were like one of the kind of number one states that were targeted precisely for this reason.
I mean, you look at Michigan, you look at Wisconsin, the states that Trump targeted, they were once Democratic strongholds, but they're also states that became right to work states over the past few years. And they've completely destroyed unions, funding efforts in these states, and they've taken them over. And really, Scott Wagner is the final nail in that coffin here in Pennsylvania.
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, you see the same mistakes made by the Democratic Party, right, at the leadership level here. You know, again, look, one of the reasons why Scott Walker wanted to go after on unions so bad, right, and make it right to work, because they recognize that unions are virtually the only
funding source.
And not just funding source, but boots on the ground. I mean, actually, the kind of the organized, the people who have historical legacy, know how to organize. Yeah, exactly. It's like, so not only do you have kind of sources of funding and so on, but now you're looking at this, you're seeing the same kind of stuff that we saw in the national election, is that you've got, you know, years of, you know, yes, I mean, the Democratic Party relying upon unions to do this kind of legwork, right? But there's not the transaction, right? So it's, okay, yeah, you're going to come out. You got no place else to go. So come help us get elected, or otherwise you're going to get right to work. Okay, that's what, but then in the meantime, what have you done? Right. What have you done to support workers' rights? What have you done to kind of support those the kind of quote unquote progressive agenda that you came in on? Right. So you've got the grassroots, right? The rank and file, right, are looking at this and looking at Wolf and not seeing a whole lot in it for them. Right. They're seeing kind of more of the same. And that's not a good scenario, because, I mean, if you're looking forward about building an organization that's, you know, building a campaign that's capable of winning, you've got to be able to kind of look around and say, OK, who is your allies and who are the people that are going to do the work? And Wolf has shown, you know, and I'll put this part on his shoulders. You know, this he is kind of fairly new to politics, but definitely on the shoulders of the state Democratic Party, is they've been, you know, basically doing none of that spade work. I mean, they've, you know, in this kind of elections, you know, right now, why wouldn't you be out there screaming on the top of your mind, you know, ahead about how crazy these people are? Or you've got nothing to lose anymore. I mean, again, and I want to, you know, again, counteract that with the amazing work that is happening at the grassroots level, right? So you've got this kind of push from below to mobilize on progressive issues, but then you've got a governor who seems to be doing his best to not echo what that progressive power needs to see. So, I mean, I'm a dark cloud, man. I mean, I keep just a little bit dark cloud here. And I mean, I love it. Every time we got, I mean, tomorrow, for example, we got the tax day protest. There's sister marches going all over the state of Pennsylvania. The week after that, we got the science march, right? There's also sister marches all over Pennsylvania. The week after that is the climate march. Again, sister marches all over. I mean, so people are mobilizing and organizing, doing amazing work on the ground at the local level. And that's the only thing that gives me hope for the long haul. What I worry about, it's going to take like the virtual destruction of our existing progressive institutions like labor unions and such like this through right to work walls and laws and everything like that before these people are going to get it through their heads they've been in bed with the wrong people.
Yeah. So I think I have a nice story. Bring some levity to this conversation.
Great. Bring us up to the break, man.
did you see the Ed Rendell story this week?
I saw it. Yes. And then I was kind of like, I can't look at this man anymore. He just drives me insane.
So Rendell starts out the week calling on Bob Brady to – there's a couple of stories that bring this all together.
Yeah.
So City and State publishes a thing where Ed Rendell tells Bob Brady, you know, who runs the Philadelphia Democrats, to basically get their shit together and stop it with this corruption in the ward – because basically the ward leaders are who runs Philadelphia politics. So, you know, Rendell's like pot meets kettle. You know, it's like, yo, get your shit together. And, you know, get your people in line, stop it with this corruption stuff. So as that story publishes, there's Philly Clout publishes a great story about how Rendell was a consultant for a casino with a Trump protege in Saipan. Do you know where Saipan is at?
Yes, I do.
Saipan was known for sweatshops, Tommy Hilfiger.
Exactly.
So, you know, this
It's a this, U.S. territory. U.S. territory.
U.S. territory.
Yep.
That was basically there just to be a sweatshop slave colony for
basically.
You know.
Yep.
And Rendell. So I guess that was like what 10, 15 years ago. That whole entire scandal blew up, and the Commonwealth. It's a Commonwealth. So there's only like 18 people running their legislature, and there's this casino that a Trump protege is running in Saipan. That's sandwiched between a laundromat and a convenience store, and he was getting $5,000 a month for the past year to consult for this casino, you know, be on its board of directors. And they posted like a balance that is like $3.7 billion, which was astronomically high. And casino people were saying, yeah, either they're fudging their numbers or they're laundering money. So I thought like the best quote, the best part of the story, Rendell goes, well, why the F does this matter?
Oh my God.
You know, to Bender. And he goes, you know, I asked him I asked Ron if this was, if this seems legit. He says it's legit. I did my due diligence and that's it. He's like, I did some due diligence. I asked him if it was legit. He said it was legit. So I thought it was legit.
My God. The only thing that would make this story better is that, part of it, what he said, you know, I asked my friend Carter Page and he said, it's no problem. You know, that'd be like the only thing that would make this story like more insane.
And no, like Rendell, this is the person that Wolf, you know, puts himself in bed with.
Yep.
You know, this is the Democratic Party right here. I mean, this is the microcosm of the Democratic Party. This guy ran the Democratic Party for a few years back in the aughts. You know, and like this is the person that is influencing Pennsylvania politics. This is the person who has Marcel Groen leading the Pennsylvania State Democratic Party. You know, this is like, and it's always great when you see Ed Rendell make the news. You know, I thought it was legit, so it was legit. You know,
I always say,
casino the size of a you know, in a strip mall, right, posted a $3.7 billion balance.
It's a good return for a hole in the wall. Yeah,
and now that casino. This.
Yeah,
and
go ahead, sir.
Now that casino's under federal investigation, which
yeah, it's going to be, you know, the tentacles of this, you know, of these kind of investigations be crazy, especially with all the looking in the scrutiny on money laundering stuff right now. It's just great. You know, I do have to say the one thing about Rendell is that you know, as much as I can't stand him as a politic, as like, you know, his policies and what he represents and things like this, at least he's entertaining. At least you got that.
You know, the funny thing is, as much as like people, the Republicans up here in the Hill make fun of Rendell,
mm-hmm,
a lot of them actually love Ed Rendell, because Rendell, like they love dealing with him, because Rendell taught them how to be politicians, pretty much.
That's right. Well, you know, one of my favorite things that Rendell, I'm sorry, go ahead, finish what you're going
to say. I know, like, no one ever respected Corbett because Corbett wasn't a politician.
Right.
And Corbett didn't, you know, Corbett was too busy locking their friends up, putting their friends in jail. And, you know, like, he never had that trust with the legislature. But a lot of people love Ed Rendell because he taught other Republican leaders, the people out there, how to be politicians by just dealing with them.
Right, but the Democrats didn't learn the lesson, right? And so the Republicans learned from Rendell about how to get things done. Well, one of my favorite, I saw this interview with Rendell once, and you know, it was so spot on, right? It was awesome, and he was talking about he was getting a lot of pressure put on him. You know, they're asking him hard questions, good hard questions about, you know, his kind of anti-union stuff, right? So claims you're anti-union, you're going to want to break unions up and things like this. And Rendell said, "Hey, look, like this is about a negotiation." Right. So I'm going to come and I'm going to push hard. It's up to the other side to push back, you know, and he was basically, you know, calling out, right, union leaders for basically not having their own acts together, right, for not kind of arguing and doing politics from a position of power. Right. They were kind of like expecting something else. Right. And he was basically saying, look, you're weak. Right. And the only reason that I could win this is because you're weak. I shouldn't be able to do this, but you're weak. Right. And it wasn't weak at that time. Right. It wasn't weak because, you know, you just had no members or anything like this. I mean, there were substantially more members back then when this was going on. Right. It had to do with the kind of the culture of organizing did not exist within those unions. So, you know, that always stuck with me because, you know, he had an understanding of what it meant to play politics as a power game, as opposed to, you know, you know, the myth that, you know, we're all going to get together and we're going to kind of come up with a consensus about whatever like this, you know, that whole wing of the Democratic Party, which, you know, believes somehow that, you know, Republicans give half a crap about truth. But I don't know. All right. So we're coming up to a break. When we come back, I've got some space news for you, folks. You got it. Sean is coming back to the area, back down near my neck of the woods where he's from, and for the Easter weekend, which would be pretty cool. So I get to see Sean in person this weekend. Maybe we'll even post a little Facebook Live for you, do a little like, hey, here, look, this is what it looks like when we're together. So anyways, I'll come back right after this with some fun stuff before the break. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new, sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. for as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. So, as promised, when I can and when I find the to random ends of the show kind of stuff, where I go to my happy place is I look for space news. So I'll bring that to you, and you can either shut down the podcast now or check it out. This week was actually really interesting because for the first time, at least as we know, first time in history, we saw like the first protest in space, right? Yes. So you had a, you had folks that printed out people from NASA, for the Autonomous Space Agency Network, that is NASA spelled backwards, that's NASA backwards, put together a this giant tweet. Right. And this is what it said. It said, "Look at that, you son of a bitch." Right. And tagged Trump's personal account in that. They attached it to a weather balloon and flew it at 90,000 feet. Right. So we've got an image of this from, I believe it's from the space station. Right. So that we got a, an image of the weather balloon snapped up on it and seeing that kind of tweet in there. And why that matters. Right. Well, what is this? What is all about? Well, that's because Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell, he was like the sixth person ever walk on the moon. He once said, this is a quote from him. He said, quote, "From out there on the moon, international politics look so petty. You want to grab a politician by the scruff of the neck and drag him a quarter of a million miles out and say, 'Look at that, you son of a bitch.'" Right. And that's what they put up there. So that was pretty freaking awesome. And, you know, a great little space news. And that comes at the same week. So you had some cool research that came out after looking at some findings from NASA's Cassini spacecraft, which is out there around Saturn. And they looked at Enceladus, is one of Saturn's moons. And it basically showed these water plumes that were coming out of that, which is a whole bunch of discussion about underground or under surface water, oceans and things like this. And they were basically saying that because of some of these plumes, they thought there was hydrogen there, that the conditions may exist, right? Especially if there's under the surface of the planet, which is pretty much ice, but under the surface of the planet, says there's actually hydrothermal kind of eruptions taking place under the surface. There actually may be some of the conditions from microbes and things like that to form. So kind of a cool science geek week if you're kind of interested in the space stuff at all. So, but Sean, you got your own little space story from what I understand.
Yeah, I heard a giant plume of something was spotted on the back end of Uranus this week. You know, the Hubble Space Telescope found it. So either it could hear all the crap coming our way from Donald Trump, or had a few too many beers the night before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, apparently some eruption or something like this from the solar wind particles blew up. But it's funny, blasted giant plume blasted.
And talking about flatulence, did you hear about did you hear what the governor in West Virginia did this week?
No.
Okay, so the Republicans passed this budget, right, and he vetoed it. So he was talking for like 45 minutes, and he was just rambling on about how he's going to veto this budget. And he had three trays out, like serving trays, like with like uh-huh. You open it up, there's the dinner right there. Yeah. So one's like, yeah, he said something like, "We don't have a burgerless hamburger." Pulled out like two buns, like right there. He said, we don't have a mayo sandwich either. It pulls out a mayo, like opens one up. There's a sandwich or a thing full of mayo. He's like, "What we do have is a bunch of bullshit." And he pulled out and there's like a there. He didn't say that. He said bull crap. But there is actual cow shit on top of the budget. And everyone's just looking at him. And he's like, "And I'm going to veto this thing." And he starts laughing.
He was laughing?
No, everyone in the room just started like laughing. Like the politicians behind them were just like, "Yeah." You remember that thing that press conference when Leach said, "If you're If your idea is to winning an election is to get less people to vote, then your ideas suck. And everyone around him kind of just like jaw dropped with him just saying that at a press conference.
Yeah.
Everyone just like awesome. Started laughing and just like no one knew what he was getting to. And you see like this serving tray with like 100 pieces of paper like all spread out. And he just opens it up and there's cow crap right there on the thing. What we do have here is a bunch of bull crap. It was like bull you know what, and he just lifts it up and there's a thing of cow shit on top of the budget. And he's like, and that's why I'm vetoing this bill.
Oh my god, I'm gonna find that video. I'm gonna put that in a link in the show notes. That is gonna be my happy place for today, so there's no doubt about it. Well, Sean, man, you know, I look forward to seeing you over the weekend. I hope you have a good weekend with your family and everything like this. Get to see the little one again, right? So yep. That'd be fantastic. Uncle Sean coming home right from the big capital of the state. Very cool. All right. So best wishes to all who are celebrating this weekend, and have a safe one, and hope you enjoy time with family and friends. And we will be back next week here on Out to Coop. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We're out of here, folks. See ya.